body of the pagan statue was then barbecued in the central amphitheater as a form of public humiliation, burned to ashes before the eyes of the Alexandria, which had worshipped him. Insatiate, the warlike mercenaries for Jesus then tore the temple apart stone by stone, toppling the immense marble columns, causing the walls themselves to collapse. We don't know exactly what happened to the contents of the Great Library, but they were never seen again. As Nixie concludes, a war against pagan temples was also a war against books that had all too often been stored inside them for safekeeping, a concept that, from now on, could only be recalled with irony. If they, the books in the Great Library, were burned, then this was a significant moment in what Italian scholar Luciano Canfora has called the melancholy experiences of the war waged by Christianity against the old culture and its sanctuaries, which meant against the libraries. After the destruction of the temple, the Christian rampage tore across town, attacking 2,500 additional shrines, temples, and religious sites. In Alexandria, as elsewhere, this kind of wanton mayhem was part of a wider campaign of spiritual, what today we might call psychological warfare. Theophilus would replace the ancient temple of Serapis with a church to house some relics of John the Baptist that had been procured from Palestine. It was a consciously planned provocation. The goal, in unmistakable fashion, was to claim exclusive possession of the physical and symbolic fabric of the city and capital of Egypt, which now belonged to Christ and the God of the Christians. Eunapius, a Greek historian of the era, said the Christians boasted that they had overcome the gods and reckoned their sacrilege and impiety a thing to glory in. The director and I are talking about events of the distant past, but it's hard not to make the obvious modern-day connection. In recent years, whenever ISIS henchmen ripped through an ancient Assyrian site or destroyed priceless artifacts in Iraq's Mosul Museum, Western pundits would hit the airwaves to bemoan the loss of cultural heritage. Our collective patrimony is at stake, they would say. With a clean slate, one commentator opined, ISIS seeks to present to future generations a new version of history, in which its binary narrative of ISIS heroes fighting evil will be able to flourish. Obliterating historic sites is an attempt to create a blank canvas for ISIS to build on, a new beginning. How different were the motives of the religious zealots in Alexandria, or Eleusis? Adam Villini then cites her second example, the unbelievable amount of literature that's gone missing. Just look at the theatrical tragedies we have, only 33 and a half, she tells me. But the production was much, much higher than that. Sure enough, only 19 of 77 plays attributed to Euripides have survived. For Aeschylus, who was once prosecuted for revealing the Eleusinian secrets, it's 7 out of 99. For the other Eleusinian mystic Sophocles, it's only another 7 out of more than 120. It's unknown if Euripides was initiated, but his plays contain tiny, possibly hallucinogenic details about the magical night in Eleusis. Imagine how many other clues the playwrights may have embedded into the rest of their work, all of it, and countless other records from antiquity just scrubbed from memory. The Christians can't be blamed for all of it, of course. But scholars estimate that perhaps only 1% of all classical literature has survived to the present day. Think about that. Absolutely everything we know about the ancient world is based on the tiniest fraction of its actual output. For centuries, classicists have been trying to reassemble a million-piece jigsaw puzzle with what Ezra Pound once called too gross of broken statues and a few thousand battered books. No wonder Eleusis refuses to reveal her magic. While the numbers sink in, I cut to the chase. I reach into my brown leather pouch and pull out my prized copy of The Road to Eleusis, the black sheep of the classics estate. Assuming the director has never heard of it, I explain the gist of the 40-year-old hypothesis that the Kukion was the central, psychedelic secret of the mysteries. I tell her that Wasson and Hoffman are now deceased, but that Ruck is still plugging away at Boston University, still convinced he's right. Ruck, Ruck, the director mumbles out loud to herself, drawing a blank. She shakes her head to signal that she has, in fact, never heard the name. Okay, but without getting into the details, does the idea itself strike you as strange? Is it offensive for Ruck to say that the founders of Western civilization were doing drugs? Would it bother you if, perhaps once in their lives, the ancient Greeks drank a psychedelic potion to talk to Persephone? To communicate with God? No, 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 the director quickly snaps, waving her hand in the air to dismiss the absurdity of the question. Of course not. But that seems to bother a lot of people. I am immediately reminded of a recent conversation with the eminent Swiss classicist Fritz Graf at Ohio State University. I spent the summer hounding any Greek scholar who would give me the time of day. Graf was extremely considerate from the very beginning, even if he completely disagreed with the psychedelic hypothesis. His very first email to me in July 2018 contained the unforgettable phrase, "Just to be open, I regard the Wassenruck theory as rather far-fetched." Despite that, Graf consented to a phone call, a rare opportunity to drink from the fountain of Central European wisdom that dominates the classics. Graf earned his PhD from the University of Zurich under the watchful eye of the German-born Walter Burkert, who was considered somewhat of a demigod in the field. In 1977, 1 year before the publication of The Road to Eleusis, he wrote Griechische Religion der archaischen und klassischen Epoche, published in English by Harvard University Press in 1985 as Greek Religion. It's the gold standard for any would-be classicist. I had to read it twice. It's because of prowess like Burkert's that no serious student spends much time learning Greek without a basic comprehension of German. Burkert died in 2015, so in many ways, speaking with his mentee was my personal audience with the old school at its best. When I asked why he found the relationship between Eleusis and psychedelics, quote, rather far-fetched, Graf spoke slowly and deliberately to make sure I didn't miss a syllable. The main thing is, there's not one shred of evidence in our sources. Sitting with Adam Valeni in Athens, however, that kind of skepticism is nowhere to be found. She skips right over the controversy. In fact, I think they used drugs because they wanted to have, illusions. Visions, I suggest? Visions, yes. In antiquity, this is not so strange. For example, what is the name of this plant? The one with the morphine. The poppy. Yes, the poppy, the director repeats. You see the poppy everywhere. And then there's Delphi. They say the Pythia have eaten leaves from what? From the laurel. This too provoked visions, because it has oily leaves, and the oil is, in a way, a drug. To this day, the debate rages on about what inspired the famous prophecies at the Oracle of Delphi, about 100 miles northwest of this office. What's certain is that women ran the show, just as they did in Eleusis. There would be 3 Pythias, or high priestesses, at any given time, each having dedicated her life to serving as a channel or mouthpiece for the god Apollo. The petitioners gathered around the Pythia to learn their fate. The state constitutions of Sparta and Athens were submitted for her approval by Lycurgus and Cleisthenes, respectively. In Sophocles' play, it was the Pythia who delivered the bad news to Oedipus that he would kill his father and marry his mother. Walter Burkert includes this fascinating depiction in Greek religion. After a bath in the Castalian spring, and after the preliminary sacrifice of a goat, she enters the temple, which is fumigated with barley meal and laurel leaves, on the ever-burning Hestia, Greek for hearth, and descends into the Adyton, the sunken area at the end of the temple interior. There is where the Omphalos, Greek for navel, it was the rounded stone thought to be the center of the world, allowing direct communication with the gods, and where, over a round, well-like opening in the ground, the tripod cauldron is set up. Seated over the chasm, enveloped by the rising vapors, and shaking a freshly cut bay branch, she falls into a trance. A number of theories have been proposed to explain how the Pythia's trance was induced. Burkert agreed with the 1948 edition of the Oxford Classical Dictionary, noting the fact that volcanic fumes rising up from the earth has been disproved geologically. The ecstasy is self-induced. He may have been one damn fine classicist, but Burkert was no earth scientist. While past geologists attempted to disprove the rising vapors theory, a fresh interdisciplinary team came along in 2002 with 2 decades worth of evidence. The geologist, archaeologist, chemist, and toxicologist showed that the priestesses of Apollo were likely under the influence of ethylene, a sweet-smelling gas once used as an anesthetic that can produce feelings of aloof euphoria. In 1981, Two hidden geological faults were serendipitously uncovered when the Greek government decided to carve into the hillside east of Delphi to make room for tour buses. In 1996, long after Burckhardt's Greek Religion had been published, the new team finally surveyed the site, revealing that the sanctuary's underlying strata were bituminous limestone containing up to 20% blackish oils. It wasn't volcanism, but petrochemicals like ethylene that could do the job. The psychoactive gas would be released into the temple groundwaters whenever the bitumen was heated by rather simple geologic action. In 2000, the team's toxicologist, Dr. Henry A. Spiller, lent further support to the theory after pharmacological analysis of a bedrock sample from the site. To him, the effects of ethylene were well known. In the first stages, it produces disembodied euphoria, an altered mental status, and a pleasant sensation. It's what street people would call getting high. The greater the dose, the deeper you go. All this just to demonstrate three simple points. First, the classics are at their best when the experts and specialists from a wide range of disciplines are able to converge on one thorny problem. That million-piece jigsaw puzzle needs all the help it can get. Second, as we saw in the last chapter, with Heinrich Schliemann, Milman Parry, and Michael Ventris, it's not always the seasoned pros who get it right. New finds and new data are always just around the corner, and we never know where they're going to turn up next. And third, when it comes to drugs, classicists are simply out of their depth. Aside from the ethylene, there's no ruling out the barley meal or laurel leaves as additional tools for causing or enhancing the Pythia's altered state of consciousness. The plants were long associated with Delphi by Plutarch and Aeschylus. In a total blind spot, however, a scholar as formidable as Burckhardt fails to comment on the potentially psychoactive properties of ancient Greek laurel the way Adam Valeni just did, off the top of her head, no less. Not that Burckhardt wasn't generally open to the idea, by the way. On the immediately preceding page of Greek Religion, when discussing the ghostly visions reported at the Oracle of the Dead at Ephyra, he speculates that perhaps the eating of certain kinds of beans had a hallucinogenic effect. I like that word, perhaps. A far cry from the ecstasy is self-induced. That kind of absolutism can stifle creative solutions that bring all the evidence to bear. With that in mind, perhaps the thick, smoky incense of barley meal is yet another secret indication to initiates, like the one spotted by Wasson and Hoffman in the Hymn to Demeter. The LSD and psilocybin-like magic of the relatively common ergot fungus might not survive the heat, but a witchy plant or herb that wound up in the barley meal could certainly make for hallucinogenic incense. Or perhaps it really was the laurel leaves that did the trick. Speculation aside, so much remains unknown about drugs in the ancient world. Rigorous scholarship in this field is still largely absent from the classics curriculum, and even considered taboo. One of the only classicists to pick up where Ruck left off is Dr. David Hillman, who also sports a master's degree in bacteriology. In order to complete his PhD on the use of medicinal drugs in the Roman Republic, Hillman was instructed by his thesis advisor to delete all references to the recreational use of narcotics, stimulants, and psychedelics in antiquity. Hillman obeyed, later publishing his controversial findings in The Chemical Muse, Drug Use and the Roots of Western Civilization in 2008. The London Times referred to his study as the last wild frontier of classical studies. In personal correspondence, Hillman explained that the medical and pharmaceutical texts that contain the evidence for ancient drugs are simply too complex for classicists, as they require a working knowledge of biology, botany, anatomy, physiology, pathology, epidemiology, and pharmacology. As an example, Hillman cited Galen, the personal physician to Marcus Aurelius, who wrote extensively about drugs. Born to Greek parents in Pergamon around AD 130, Galen's prolific output in Greek guided the practice of Western medicine up through the American Civil War and was especially influential in the Byzantine Empire and Islamic world. Despite the fact that there are more surviving works of Galen than of Homer, Pindar, Herodotus, Sophocles, Aristophanes, Euripides, Plato, and Aristotle combined, none of his pharmaceutical treatises has ever been translated into English. The blind spot that affected Burckhardt and continues to plague most classicists to this day doesn't seem to have clouded director Adam Villani's thinking. When I ask her why she believes drugs were involved at Eleusis or Delphi, she quips, "I'm Greek. It's common knowledge, this." So it's not that controversial here? I think of all the German and Swiss eyes that would be rolling if they could hear this. Aside from Albert Hofmann, of course. No, not at all. Here, it's very natural. Just then, the director's cell phone rings, and she attends to some urgent business. For the first time since we sat down, I remember where I am and who I'm talking to. I deem it best to let Adam Villani get back to preserving the antiquities of the oldest cities in Europe instead of answering random questions from a random American, but not without a parting gift of poetry. While the director is chattering away at lightning speed in modern Greek, I reach back into my pouch and fish out my Homer from the plastic freezer bag that sheathes it. That ancient Greek edition of the Odyssey with the baby blue jacket, first published by Oxford University Press in 1917. The only non-Greek letters in the entire book are the copyright page, in English, and the introduction by Thomas W. Allen, composed in Latin for no reason whatsoever. That's just how they did it in the glory days. There was no way I was going to Athens without my college textbook. I'd been waiting too long to discuss a clue that I noticed in the Greek almost 20 years ago. And the director had just provided the long-awaited segue by referring to the use of drugs in antiquity as something that is, quote, common knowledge and natural. Something that, perhaps, had been there from the very beginning. Something so ingrained in the way religion used to be practiced that it makes little sense to question, despite the unnatural bias that 21st century American classicists and historians have about drugs. I flip the Odyssey open to Book 10, where the witches of Eleusis and Delphi would have found their idol, the rock star sorceress who started it all. Widely feared and respected for her encyclopedic knowledge of plants and herbs, the goddess Circe gets a leading role in the oldest surviving work of Western literature, a story that Milman Parry proved to be the written legacy of a deeper oral tradition that stretched back long before the 8th or 7th centuries BC, the conventional dating for Homer. After a close call with the giant Laestrygonians, Odysseus and his crew wash up on the mythological island of Aeaea, which, don't worry, no classicist knows how to pronounce either. Circe drugs the hero's men and turns them into pigs so she can have her way with Odysseus. With a little help from the god Hermes, who supplies an herbal antidote to shield the mere mortal, Odysseus manages to beat Circe at her own game of hocus pocus. Impervious to her charms, he subdues the enchantress, releasing his friends from the wicked spell. For kicks, Odysseus spends a year on Aeaea as Circe's lover, drinking sweet wine with his mates. Like the hymn to Demeter, Book 10 of the Odyssey contains a recipe. Homer reveals the contents of the elixir that Circe concocted to make swine of the men, a key piece of evidence cited by Ruck in The Road to Eleusis. The passage had always intrigued me. While preparing for class one day back in college, I had scribbled the word potion into the margin of the ancient Greek text. My minuscule handwriting was an early suspicion that these few lines of poetry had something to do not only with Eleusis, but also with the bigger puzzle about the origins of religion in general. As the director wraps up her call, I alert her to a little-known line of research that implicates ancient Greece in a web of drugs that may have once connected the entire ancient world. When you say natural, the idea of drugs being natural. Yes, for us it's so familiar, Adam Villani adds. Well, I think it might be natural or familiar because it comes from the foundational text of Western civilization, Circe mixing the pharmaka. Yes, pharmaka, drugs, she chimes in, translating the Greek word pharmaka that gave us the English word pharmacy. As I pass her the distinct Oxford edition, the director scrunches her eyebrows. So you speak ancient Greek? Have a look at line 290 where Homer mentions the pharmaka. He even uses the noun kukio for the mixed potion that Circe uses to turn the men into pigs, just like the kukion from Eleusis. The director knows exactly which passage I'm referring to and begins reading the ancient hexameter out loud. The music of the language transports me to younger days. In English, Hermes' classic warning to Odysseus goes like this. She, Circe, will mix thee a potion, kukio, and cast drugs, pharmaka, into the food. I ask the director to flip back another page, just to the right of my one-word note to self, potion. She examines the fresh ingredients of Circe's kukion, embedded in lines 233 to 236. There, Homer tells us the grand high witch mixed anemiske, the evil drugs, pharmakalugra, into the men's food after having stirred up or mixed up a special potion for the occasion. The Greek verb ekouka is used, from the same root as koukion. That potion consists of cheese, barley, honey, and Pramnian wine, a dry, strong wine from the Greek island of Icaria. There's that barley again. Perhaps a significant clue, I thought, even a couple decades ago. In the process of reading The Road to Eleusis, I discovered Ruck's reference to a paper entitled Let Us Now Praise Famous Grains, published in the Proceedings of the American Philosophical Society in February 1978 by Calvert Watkins. It immediately caught my attention because Watkins, professor emeritus of linguistics and classics at Harvard, had popped up in my Sanskrit studies. I hadn't known he was working on Eleusis as well. Watkins' paper makes a brilliant case for the true origin of Circe's magic. Although it's virtually unreadable for non-specialists, the all-knowing scholar who died in 2013, a towering figure, marshals an artillery of obscure comparative linguistic evidence across no fewer than 12 Indo-European languages. 12! All in an effort to demonstrate why this and other passages from the Iliad and the Odyssey match with exact correspondence the core features of a well-documented ritual from ancient India. A ritual that certainly predates Eleusis and, in Watkins' opinion, influenced both Demeter's actual koukion, used in the Mysteries, and Circe's mythical koukion, as portrayed by Homer. The mysterious lost tongue that connects India to Greece is known as Proto-Indo-European. Its exact homeland remains unknown. As it transformed over time and distance, however, the language retained certain core links in vocabulary and grammar to its original source. This uncanny ability of Proto-Indo-European to adapt to its environment made Indo-European the most successful family of languages in history, one or another of which is natively spoken by almost half the planet today. On the Western front, the Indo-Europeans would spawn the Baltic, Slavic, Germanic, Hellenic, Celtic, and Italic languages, which gave the ancient world Greek and Latin. Nowadays, that branch of the family tree includes everything from Russian and German to Spanish and English. Heading east from the Eurasian homeland, the same Indo-Europeans would mix with entirely different populations to produce the Indo-Iranian languages. Today, those archaic roots have evolved into Hindi, Urdu, Bengali, Punjabi, and Persian. In classical antiquity, the best documented survivor of this eastern branch is the Sanskrit language that made its way across the Himalayas into India. On my very first day of Sanskrit class, as an undergraduate, I was introduced to the following quote from 1785 by the Anglo-Welsh philologist Sir William Jones. The Sanskrit language, whatever be its antiquity, is of a wonderful structure, more perfect than the Greek, more copious than the Latin, and more exquisitely refined than either, yet bearing to both of them a stronger affinity, both in the roots of verbs and in the forms of grammar, than could possibly have been produced by accident. So strong, indeed, that no philologer could examine them all three without believing them to have sprung from some common source which, perhaps, no longer exists. Sanskrit was a holy language with a mystical purpose, the earliest written example of which is the Rig Veda, a collection of sacred hymns composed as early as 1700 BC. They may represent the oldest extant literature of any Indo-European language. If the Iliad and the Odyssey are the mother texts of Western civilization, then the Rig Veda is our grandmother. And there we find the original mixed potion, a sacramental drink called Soma. In the Rig Veda, Soma is both a plant and the god residing in the plant. Just like the koukion of Circe and Demeter, the preparation of Soma is often tied to the female presence. It is referred to as the elixir of life, and it is explicitly characterized as madira, the Sanskrit term that Watkins translates as intoxicant or hallucinogenic. One particularly memorable line from the Rig Veda reads, "We have drunk Soma and become immortal. We have attained the light, the gods discovered." After surveying the linguistic data, Watkins concludes that the similarities between the Soma ritual of the Rigveda and the ritual act of communion of the Eleusinian Mysteries, by women for women, cannot be mere coincidence. Quote, just too striking for a fortuitous resemblance to be plausible. And while the Circe passage above seems like a silly little children's story about witches and pigs, Homer is in fact describing a religious ritual, a liturgical act of Indo-European date identical with the Soma ritual of Vedic India. For the spiritual language of the ancient Greeks and Indians to be so profoundly interconnected, Sir William Jones's inkling about the common source of both Hellenic and Sanskrit must have been correct. Later on in this investigation, we will return to the hotly debated prehistoric origins of Proto-Indo-European, the mother tongue that seems to have introduced the religious use of drugs to both Greece and India, expanding outward over an ancient global triangle binding modern-day Iceland to Siberia to Sri Lanka, a secret pharmacology that somehow found its way into the subterranean catacombs we visit in Rome, now under the exclusive jurisdiction of the Vatican. Is it possible that the linguistic success of Indo-European had something to do with this religious ritual or liturgical act that its speakers carried across the planet? If Soma was undeniably, quote, hallucinogenic, perhaps the Kukion was as well. Wasson certainly thought so, and if he could identify the unknown species behind Soma, the Kukion might fall into place as well. Instead of a plant, however, Wasson suggested the visionary Amanita muscaria mushroom as the grandmother of all psychedelic rituals. Before he teamed up with Hoffman and Ruck, the ethnomycologist published his own breakout study in 1968, Soma, Divine Mushroom of Immortality. Right or wrong about the Indian sacrament, it's not the point. When Adam Baleni says that the relationship between drugs and religion is natural, I think this is what she's referring to. After all, Soma and the Kukion have been around a hell of a lot longer than the war on drugs. The director agrees with me, and with the general thrust of Watkins' inquiry into the origins of the Greek sacrament. But if I'm in search of the roots of the mysteries, she tells me there is only one person who can really help my investigation. So just as I'm about to leave, the director gives me the personal contacts for her friend and colleague, Calliope Papangeli, the chief excavator of Eleusis for the past many decades. After weeks of trying and failing to get in touch with the elusive archaeologist, I finally have my connection. The second I leave the director's office, I stand at the corner of the National Archaeological Museum and call Papangeli's cell phone 3 times, hoping for a miracle. I then send her a text, begging to meet, before I have to fly back to Washington. I make my way to a cozy little wine bar called Oinocent, only a couple blocks from my apartment back in the Plaka district. As I'm downing my second glass of Limnio from the Kikones vineyard, named after the ancient winemaking tribe that Homer placed in Thrace, my pocket buzzes. The rendezvous with Papangeli is set for the next morning in Eleusis. Chapter 4. Secret of Secrets. I'm standing in front of the breathtaking Acropolis Museum. Brainchild of the Swiss-French architect Bernard Schumi, the design received high honors from the American Institute of Architects in 2011. And rightly so. The whole structure floats majestically over existing excavations, all visible underfoot as you ascend a translucent ramp to the front entrance. Natural light floods the high-ceilinged interior of the ground level, the result of Schumi using contemporary glass technology to protect against excessive heat and exposure. The effect is absolutely hypnotizing on the top floor, where 48 modern columns create a colonnade in the exact configuration that would have formed the original cella of the ancient Parthenon. Glistening in the sun are the original pristine marbles of the temple's frieze, the half that weren't stolen by Lord Elgin and deposited in the British Museum in the early 19th century. Unfortunately, I'm not here to enjoy any of it for long. Before my meeting with Calliope Papangeli in Eleusis, the only thing I've come for is a guidebook. I'm hoping for a little more background on the recent show I just missed, Eleusis, The Great Mysteries. I purchase a copy of the very elegant Burnt Orange exhibition catalog from the open-air museum shop and head to one of the long wooden benches in the spacious foyer. The cover features a 4x7-inch cardboard insert of a robed, scepter-bearing Demeter in profile, facing right. It's a close-up photograph of the marble stele in the National Archaeological Museum, dated between 470 and 450 BC. The goddess's right hand can't be seen in the image, but the original holds a sheaf of grain stalks. In his catalog introduction, Dr. Demetrios Pandermalis, president of the Acropolis Museum, calls Eleusis the most prominent of all the visionary mystery cults, promising personal bliss in life and happiness after death. Even so, he includes the kind of perfunctory sketch of the Kukion that would make Fritz Graf proud. Potential initiates would break their fast by drinking the Kukion, a mixture of water, flour, and royal mint. Full stop. Then, as Pandermalis closes his brief summary of the mysteries, he grabs my full attention. It is our hope that this exhibition will be the herald for the celebratory year 2021, when Eleusis will serve as the cultural capital of Europe. Within the captivating sacred silence of that site, we await the humming sounds of new initiates. A quick tour of Eleusis2021.eu confirms what, for me, is breaking news. Director Adam Baleni had mentioned something about this festival in passing, but I guess I was distracted by all the talk of the Great Library, the missing 99% of classical literature, and psychedelic witches. After more than 1,600 years in the shadows, Eleusis is once again taking the world stage. This time, in a series of European Union-financed educational and arts initiatives across four main themes. The Demeter Mother Earth program focuses on our relationship with food. The Persephone program focuses on our relationship with urban green areas, gardens, and flowers. The Ecoculture program focuses on climate change, energy, and recycling. Finally, the Feminine Nature program focuses on cultural heritage and femininity. A letter on the website from the mayor of Eleusis, Giorgio Tsoukalas, laments the industrialization that overran the ancient city toward the end of the 19th century, leaving a powerful footprint in the form of a series of derelict factories along the coastline that now overlooks the otherwise crystalline Gulf of Elefsina. As if the church hadn't adequately wiped the sanctuary off the map back in the 4th century AD, Tsoukalas quotes Nikos Gatsos, a 20th century Greek poet, to capture the scope of the modern desecration. Where the initiates joined hands reverently before entering the sanctuary, now the tourists discard cigarette butts and visit the new refinery. Sleep, Persephone, in the earth's embrace. Come out no more to the balcony of the world. Just when there was no hope for the deteriorating town, the diplomats in Brussels come bearing a quintessentially Eleusinian gift, resurrection. A public festival known as the Contemporary Mysteries is in the works, along with myriad events and activities centered on the very 21st century theme of reconnecting to Mother Nature. It comes at a time of unprecedented planetary crisis, hastened by climate change. The decline of mammals, birds, fish, reptiles, and amphibians by an average of 60% since 1970 threatens the survival of human civilization. Some scientists are calling this the sixth mass extinction event, the likes of which have only occurred five other times in the past 443 million years. In the past, such events could result in the disappearance of 95% of all life on Earth. We are a fragile species on a fragile planet. The ancient Greeks knew that. Death was always lurking just around the next corner. But Eleusis was there to defend them against whichever Greek word you prefer: cataclysm, catastrophe, holocaust, apocalypse. Scrolling through my phone in the museum foyer, I can't help but think of Vettius Agorius Praetextatus, a high-profile aristocrat of the 4th century AD. A prefect, consul, and hierophant, literally a priest who shows the sacred things, he held a number of respected political and religious positions in the Roman Empire. And like Cicero and Marcus Aurelius before him, Praetextatus was also initiated into the mysteries. He was one of those cosmopolitan Romans who felt there was something truly extraordinary about Eleusis. Whatever the sublime vision revealed about the nature of existence, there was more at stake than just personal salvation. Much more. In AD 364, the Christian Emperor Valentinian abolished all nocturnal celebrations in an effort to shut down the mysteries. The almost 2,000-year march of pilgrims to Eleusis was in serious jeopardy of screeching to a halt. The Greek historian Zosimus credits Praetextatus with successfully convincing the powerful Valentinian to backtrack, permitting the entire rite to be performed in the manner inherited from the ancestors. But it's what the initiate says to the emperor that, among all the strange things about Eleusis, always struck me as the strangest by far. It's a prophecy of sorts. Faced with the obliteration of the most sacred mysteries, Praetextatus declares that the short-sighted law would make the life of the Greeks unlivable. Having drunk the Kukion and experienced the vision for himself, the priest points to Eleusis as the one place that, quote, holds the whole human race together. The Greek word for unlivable is abiotos, literally the absence or opposite of life. It's a rare, evocative word. The eminent Hungarian scholar Karl Kerenyi is fascinated by it in his seminal 1962 book on the mysteries, written in German, Die Mysterien von Eleusis. Kerenyi concludes that the word was consciously chosen to inform later generations that the mysteries were, quote, connected not only with Athenian and Greek existence, but with human existence in general. The prophecy comes at a critical moment in the history of Western civilization, when very little stood between Eleusis and the torches and pitchforks of the Christian mobs. Beyond any doubt, says Kerenyi, a distinct contrast is being drawn between the lovers of Demeter and Jesus. The sharpness of the formulation of the significance of Eleusis, which has no parallel in earlier documents, springs from the conflict between Greek religion and Christianity. In the epic battle of competing faiths that would erupt into the identity crisis we still suffer today, it was only the mysteries that could guarantee a sustainable future for the human species and the planet. According to Praetextatus, the Temple of Demeter housed something indispensable that was utterly lacking in the Christian faith. Without that original sacrament, inherited from the ancestors, we'd all be doomed. But why? How exactly did Demeter prevent not just Greek existence, but human existence from becoming unlivable? How did the goddess whom Ruck refers to as the Earth Mother put our species in accord with nature? For the disgraced classicist, it's all about the secret of secrets, a phrase he coined to describe the archaic tradition of agricultural and biochemical expertise that was somehow able to manufacture the Kukion year after year. A vast trove of mysterious lore passed on by word of mouth from herbalist to apprentice throughout the long life of the mysteries. The harvesting of the ergot-infected grain and the mixing of the sacrament are believed to represent the origin of all human science that reveals the mystery of death and rebirth. But because of the volatile properties of ergot, the production of the magic potion is only possible when the untamed lives in harmony with the domesticated. That trademark balance between yin and yang that the Greeks identified as chaos and cosmos. Literally, chaos is the infinite darkness of unformed matter that existed in the first state of the universe, while cosmos is the natural order of the final product that we now glimpse in the night sky. Trained by the female elders, the priestesses would have overseen the cultivation of the fields at Eleusis. Ruck sees that painstaking process as the thin line between the wild, nomadic ways of a prehistoric era and the civilized institutions rooted in the Greeks' biotechnology. Grain itself is a curious creature, carefully evolved from more primitive grasses. When the crops are not tended with proper care, a dangerous weed begins to grow. It's barley's evil stepsister, darnel. The scientific name is Lolium temulentum. In Greek, it was Aira, a plant associated with divine frenzy. The funny thing about darnel, or Aira, is that it serves as an excellent host for what else? Ergot. The job of the priestesses, Ruck contends, would have been to monitor closely the growth of the darnel and ergot so that neither got out of control. Too much, and the deadly weed and fungus can ruin the entire crop, threatening life itself. Too little, and there's no active ingredient for the Kukion. Only when chaos and cosmos work together do the raw, psychedelic ingredients of the sacrament result. And only when the ordered, rational psyche is overwhelmed with a proper dosage of ergot-derived alkaloids does the disruptive, irrational vision result. A sight that made all previous seeing seem like blindness. What Ruck calls the culminating experience of a lifetime. Under the visionary spell of the Kukkyon, Persephone is thought to have revealed the mystery of death and rebirth directly to the initiates. That's why Demeter set up the mysteries of Eleusis in the first place, so Persephone could establish a personal relationship with each of the pilgrims. According to Ruck, they would meet her face to face in that liminal space between this life and the next, convinced they'd been given access to the true nature of reality. In the underworld that had invaded Demeter's temple, they would witness Persephone give birth to a holy child. It's unknown whether Persephone was there in the flesh, perhaps played by a Greek priestess, or wholly envisioned in the mind's eye. Maybe it was some special combination of the two that the ergot facilitated. The point is, the initiates believed it. They apparently couldn't explain the vision away as wacky hallucinations, rattled brain chemistry, or wishful thinking. For those who had drunk the Kukkyon, it was a peek into another freestanding reality, similar to the one Gordon Wasson described back in the 1950s as crisper, sharper, brighter, and more real than the black and white, imperfect version we accept without question day after day. In The Varieties of Religious Experience from 1902, psychologist William James used the term noetic quality to capture those rare moments of insight into depths of truth unplumbed by the discursive intellect. The mystic can experience illuminations, revelations full of significance and importance, all inarticulate though they remain, and as a rule, they carry with them a curious sense of authority for after time. Perhaps what the mysteries offered was the kind of ego-dissolving insight that was always cherished by the Christian mystics and suppressed by the Christian establishment. Once you become a mystic, there's no unseeing God. After a brush with what Aldous Huxley calls the unfathomable mystery, things are never quite the same for the modern initiates either. Across the board, volunteers in the Hopkins and NYU experiments report becoming better versions of themselves. More open, more compassionate, more forgiving, more loving. Bathed in God's love, atheist Dinah Baser was finally able to appreciate and connect with people on a profound level for the first time in her life. When we spoke, she described falling in love with her family all over again. She recalled being surprised by the sheer goodness of others. "I don't think I realized how genuine people were until after this experience." But it wasn't an indulgent, self-obsessed New Ager that exited the psilocybin session, someone on the narcissistic hunt for her personal happiness and well-being. It was a socially conscious Dinah who felt an innate sense of belonging as a fully-fledged member of the human tribe, passionately concerned about the future of the planet that her grandchildren's generation will inherit. Some have begun referring to this effect as the science of awe. A recent article in Psychology Today explains the phenomenon as a sense of embeddedness into collective folds and an increase in pro-social behavior such as kindness, self-sacrifice, cooperation, and resource sharing. Experiences that arouse awe can help us to reconceptualize our sense of self, our role in society, and from a more cosmic perspective, our place in the universe. Clinical psychologist William Richards, the longtime collaborator in the Johns Hopkins psilocybin trials, concludes that ethics and morality are hardwired, perhaps genetically encoded, within the human organism. Psilocybin appears to unlock that code by tapping directly into what the mystics have been trying to mine over the history of Christianity with all their chanting, meditation, fasting, and prayer, and what the religious authorities try to beat into young children, as if decency and virtue were things to be learned, rather than natural impulses to be coaxed into expression. Is this what Praetextatus meant by Eleusis holding, quote, the whole human race together, and life becoming, quote, unlivable in their absence? Did the transformational inner journey unleashed by the Kukkyon remind us how to care for one another and the planet? Was this the true technology on which Western civilization was built? Is a society that fails to incorporate this mystical experience fundamentally flawed, its institutions empty of the shared vision that made the world's first democracy actually work? If so, that could very well explain the obvious distinction Praetextatus was trying to make between Eleusis and Christianity. By the 4th century AD, the church's mainstream Eucharist of ordinary bread and wine had replaced whatever heretical sacraments came before, as we will fully explore in the second half of this book. But another part of the campaign to rid the world of pagan influence, argues Ruck, was Christianity's exclusion of women from positions of leadership, the same women, the grandmothers, who were so integral to sustaining the secret of secrets in ancient Greece. Like many pre-Christian cultures, the Greeks revered the goddess in three principal forms: the young virgin, Persephone, the adult mother, Demeter, and the old crone, Demeter, once Persephone had given birth during the climax of the mysteries. According to Ruck, Demeter's transition to grandmother brings her closer to death and confers on her a mysterious power over plants. As she continues to mature, only then does the female's ancient religious power come to perfection through her awesome compact with the terrible metaphysical sources of life. Just like the Pythias at the Oracle of Delphi, whom the Greek historian Diodorus Siculus tells us were always over the age of 50, Demeter, in her new incarnation as the prototypic witch, also inspired the Eleusinian priestess. Isn't it strange that the Christian Holy Family, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, is an all-male ensemble? And isn't it even stranger that the only woman worshipped alongside the Trinity never becomes a grandmother? The church would prize Mary's virginity and motherhood above all else. Instead of marveling at the grandmother's botanical know-how, the church would demonize it. After the 4th century AD, Demeter and the old crone archetype slowly disappeared. The same woman hunted by the Inquisition would eventually become the spooky lady stirring the bubbling green goop in the cauldrons of our Halloween books and Disney movies. The evil sorceress up to no good. But according to Maria Tatar, who chairs the program in folklore and mythology at Harvard University, old women in fairy tales and folklore practically keep civilization together. They judge, reward, harm, and heal. They're often the most intriguing characters in the story. And they are the most intriguing real-life characters of this investigation, as we will see in detail in the Vatican's archive of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. I slip my phone back into my pocket and stare at Ruck's Earth Mother on the cover of the exhibition catalog. So that's why the Acropolis Museum decided to host Eleusis, the Great Mysteries, to create a little momentum for the ancient sanctuary's metamorphosis into the European capital of culture in 2021. When the European Union talks about restoring our relationship with Demeter and Persephone and reviving the feminine nature of Eleusis, I doubt Ruck's 40-year-old theory about a secret sisterhood of psychedelic priestesses is what they have in mind. No one in the contemporary Mysteries Festival is going to be thrown back an ergot-infused barley potion. Still, I can't quite grasp why anyone is paying attention to Eleusis, a small town of about 30,000 people. Why now? A site once sacred to Mother Nature, today choked by oil refineries and cement factories. I get the metaphor, but for those of us stuck in the past, there's more meaning here. I step outside into the blinding sun of a flawless Friday to continue meditating on Praetextatus' prophecy, and to visit the one place in Athens where the ancient Greeks could never deny the awesome power of the earth or her unlimited supply of natural drugs. I head a few yards north to the perimeter of the rocky citadel that juts from the ground, the Parthenon perched on its peak. The tourists are out and about now, making the walk a little less pleasant than this morning's. But as I reach the world's first theater, cut directly into the southern slope of the Acropolis, the crowds dissipate. I take a seat on one of the stone benches in the semicircular terrace facing the absent stage. Tufts of grass sprout between the marble thrones in the front row, where the priest of Dionysus and other VIPs may have enjoyed the performance in the same drugged stupor as the Greeks in the nosebleeds at the back. Euripides, Aeschylus, Sophocles, Aristophanes, they all competed here to curry favor with the god of ecstasy during the great Dionysia at the beginning of spring. Unlike us today, the Greeks had no firm boundary between religion and entertainment. The whole point of the performance was to approach more nearly to the presence of their divinity. No different from Eleusis. Dionysus wasn't symbolized by the wine. He was the wine. When a Greek celebrant ingested the fruit of the vine, she ingested the god himself. How else do we explain the concept of enthusiasm, derived from entheos, meaning divine frenzy or God-possessed inspiration, considered the one quality more than any other that gave birth to tragedy? The British scholar Peter Hoyle best described how, at that moment of intense rapture, Dionysius's maenads, or female devotees, became identified with the god himself. They became filled with his spirit and acquired divine powers. According to Ruck, the nature of the theater experience was one of mass spiritual possession that can be traced back to shamanic rituals at the tombs of heroic persons, with the spirit of the deceased overtaking the priest and speaking through him or her to tell the dead person's story or myth. The Greeks brought this dangerous intoxication of the god from the primordial countryside, right here, to the very center of our ancient democracy, where the poetry of drama turned the unique Athenian dialect known as Koine, or Common Greek, into the language of the New Testament. Our ancestors could quote the Greek uttered in this amphitheater as easily as we might quote favorite lines from Hollywood. So Koine persisted well past the Gospels, becoming the lingua franca of the Church Fathers and the early Byzantine Empire. To this day, it remains the liturgical language of the Greek Orthodox Church. Behind it all was the special wine that was served in this theater, trimma, which literally means something rubbed or pounded. Ruck explains the drink took the name from whatever additives were ground into the potion to produce a communal feeling of oneness among the spectators, with their shared cultural identity and with the spirits who were the city's metaphysical allies from the other world. The bewitching that began with the actors, who drew down their ethereal characters through the magnets of makeup and wardrobe, would soon be transferred to the audience, all attuned to the ghostly possession. I can only imagine the atmosphere in 405 BC when Euripides the Bacchae debuted here, just after the playwright's death. How could he possibly have missed the show that would become the greatest tribute to the Dionysian mysteries that antiquity ever produced? We know almost as little about the wine god's secret ceremonies, or the cryptic potions that nourish them, as we know about Eleusis. But like a Bible for maenads who otherwise thrived in a world of hushed oral tradition, the Bacchae left behind a thick trail of clues that we will begin exploring later in this book. Clues that lead to a magical version of Jesus, equal parts natural healer, initiator of mysteries, and concoctor of drugged wine. Unknown to many faithful today, it's a version that places the founder of Christianity in the kind of detailed historical context that would have been self-evident to the earliest generations of Greek-speaking Paleo-Christians. Fortunately, our investigation is right on target, because one can hardly approach the god of ecstasy without first unpacking the mysteries of Eleusis. Before he seduced the fans of this very theater into the wild mountains and forests that would form his impromptu outdoor churches all across the Mediterranean well into the Roman period, Dionysus snuck his way into Eleusis as the child of Persephone. It hadn't always been that way, but the miraculous birth of the holy child named Iachus, who closed the mysteries in the Temple of Demeter, came more and more to be associated with the god of ecstasy. In his doctoral dissertation from 1974, Fritz Graf himself penned the definitive study on how the delirium, frenzy, and madness associated with the god of ecstasy made their mark on Eleusis. Though he's no fan of the psychedelic hypothesis, Graf freely admits the irrational aspects of the rites that once belonged to Demeter and Persephone. During our conversation over the summer, he told me, indeed, it's undoubted that the initiates in Eleusis could have had, let's say, ecstatic experiences, or something like that. For me, the most compelling argument is that Iachus, the god who was leading the procession to Eleusis, is understood as a form of Dionysus already by Sophocles in the 5th century. So, if Dionysus is present in Eleusis, that points to experiences that, for the native initiate, were comparable to what you would experience when undergoing the Dionysiac rites. Suddenly, Praetextatus pops into my mind. Why did he schlep here all the way from his lavish home in Rome? Would he really have trained for a year and a half, fasted for days, and walked the half marathon from Athens to Eleusis for a second time just to meet a metaphor? Like every pilgrim, Praetextatus might remind us, He came to mourn with Demeter and spy Persephone and Dionysus in the flesh. And if Ruck is right, he didn't just come to sample an innocuous potion, he came to absorb divinity. Just as the enthusiastic Pythias might find Apollo in the mind-altering Laurel, or Dionysus might slither through the Trimma to possess his devotees. So Praetextatus might become one with the original Holy Family, the boundary between all living things forever dissolved, with what William James would call a curious sense of authority. The classicist E.R. Dodds emphasizes the side effects of the original Dionysian sacrament that, very much like the Koukion of Eleusis, seems to have made life livable by drawing the human species and Mother Nature into a shared embrace. A merging of the individual consciousness in a group consciousness, the worshipper Thiasuetai Psuchan joins his soul to the group. He is at one not only with the master of life, but with his fellow worshipers, and he is at one also with the life of earth. Whatever happened to that sacrament? In the midst of our apparent global extinction event, would Praetextatus be having his I told you so moment? He warned us over 1600 years ago that if the mysteries ever died, we would die. That whatever Christianity was offering, it was no match for the spiked beer Eucharist of Demeter and Persephone, or the spiked wine Eucharist of Dionysus. How much longer can we afford business as usual until life becomes truly unlivable? We are sleepwalking toward the edge of a cliff, say the scientists, and no one seems to care. Praetextatus might get a real kick out of all the climate activists and conservationists slamming their heads against the wall, trying to explain the gravity of the situation to the rest of us. The vulnerability of this lonely rock hurtling through space. The importance of Mother Nature. Perhaps the founder of the National Resources Defense Council, Gus Speth, said it best. I used to think the top environmental problems facing the world were global warming, environmental degradation, and ecosystem collapse, and that we scientists could fix those problems with enough science. But I was wrong. The real problem is not those three items, but greed, selfishness, and apathy. And for that, we need a spiritual and cultural transformation, and we scientists don't know how to do that. But maybe the Greeks did. Maybe the momentary annihilation of the ego that Praetextatus and his fellow initiates experienced at Eleusis, or the Maenads found in the ecstasy of drugged wine, was enough to glimpse the big picture. To understand that the earth is our solitary home for the moment, that we're all in this together, and that mistreating Mother Nature is more suicide than murder. I wonder how Praetextatus would react to the crown jewel of ancient Greece being named the European capital of culture after centuries in history's landfill. Like any good initiate on the constant hunt for omens and signs, would the Roman priest interpret 2021 as the muted dawning of a long-awaited comeback? Just when humanity is faced with the kind of threat that only comes along once every 100 million years? Is this one last chance for a civilization in crisis? For someone like Praetextatus, who had experienced the visionary magic of Eleusis, it might all make perfect sense, just as it did for Albert Hofmann, who, a few months before his death in April 2008, left a concluding thought on the future promise of psychedelics. Alienation from nature and the loss of the experience of being part of the living creation is the greatest tragedy of our materialistic era. It is the causative reason for ecological devastation and climate change. Therefore, I attribute absolute highest importance to consciousness change. I regard psychedelics as catalyzers for this. They are tools which are guiding our perception toward other deeper areas of human existence so that we again become aware of our spiritual essence. Psychedelic experiences in a safe setting can help our consciousness open up to this sensation of connection and of being one with nature. LSD and related substances are not drugs in the usual sense, but are part of the sacred substances which have been used for thousands of years in ritual settings. Among other precedents, Hofmann was, of course, referring to his long obsession with Eleusis. In the afterword to the 30th anniversary edition of The Road to Eleusis, also released in 2008, the Swiss chemist invoked the same god of ecstasy as his countryman, Fritz Graf. The Eleusinian mysteries were closely connected with the rites and festivities in honor of the god Dionysus, he wrote. They led essentially to healing, to the transcendence of the division between humankind and nature. One might say to the abolition of the separation between creator and creation. This was the real greater proposition of the Eleusinian mysteries. Where the chemist and the classicist radically diverge, however, is on precisely how that transcendence was achieved. When I spoke to Graf, he focused on the neurochemical power of the endorphins that would have attended the initiate's physical exhaustion after a ritual procession and several-day fast. He liked my buzz phrase, an endogenously produced ecstatic experience. Hoffman preferred something more than a runner's high. As we saw in Chapter 2, when analyzing the main arguments of the Road to Eleusis, he claimed the hallucinogenic ergot potion would have been easy to prepare with the techniques and equipment available in antiquity. Despite that conviction and several dogged attempts over the past 40 years, however, nobody has ever been able to successfully reproduce the alleged psychedelic beverage in the modern-day laboratory. At least, nothing that produced the kind of experience attested at Eleusis. If one of those 30 ergot alkaloids really did the job, we still don't know which one. The only way to determine which Swiss scholar is right is to trek 13 miles up the sacred road to see if the original religion of Western civilization is finally willing to yield any of its precious secrets. According to Praetextatus and Albert Hofmann, the fate of the world depends on it. Chapter 5. The Beatific Vision. The Eleusinian mysteries and Christianity have so much in common. When I guide people through the threads of this archaeological site, I like to stress the similarities between ancient and modern, says Kaiopi Papangeli in a lilting Greek accent. At last, I'm sitting cross-legged on the chalky ground outside the Archaeological Museum of Eleusis with the woman who has spent more time among the ruins below us than any person living today. Known to some as Poppy, Papangeli is the chief excavator of Eleusis and the world's expert on the original religion of Western civilization. For the past hour, she's been my personal escort through this forgotten, sprawling complex, 10 times bigger than I ever imagined. I was already winded by the acrobatic tour over massive blocks and boulders, shaping our path across the craggy site. Now I'm dizzy from trudging up the steep hill that grips the museum. Wiry and rail-thin, Papangeli has been doing this for decades. She is totally unfazed in her red polo shirt and navy blue khakis. We've taken shelter from the sweltering sun beneath a wooden pergola that becomes our shady retreat. Papangeli is settled on the bench beside a marble sarcophagus from the 2nd century AD. An ancient Greek master and pupil, I'm soaking in the view while the wise sage unloads a torrent of information. To my right, the Gulf of Elefsina sparkles a magnificent shade of blue I can't recall seeing before. At the bottom of the steep incline to my left, the remains of Demeter's temple lie in silence, whipped by passionate gusts of wind. Excavated earth surrounds the sanctuary on all sides in a massive, undulating footprint. If only these weathered columns could talk. I thought I journeyed here in search of answers to a very pagan Greek riddle. Did the initiates consume a psychedelic potion or not? And if so, where did it come from? In order to prove the pagan continuity hypothesis right, we have to start with the ancient Greeks and their prehistoric ancestors. My conversation with director Adam Villeni and a close read of the 20th century's giants in the field of classics, Walter Burkert and Carl Carreñi, has convinced me that Ruck's scholarship is less controversial than his reputation suggests. So I've been preparing for months to engage Papangeli in a sober discussion, hoping to unpack 40 years of academic bias against drugs. Only after the visionary Kukion is established does the possibility of the early Christians inheriting the biotechnology behind it become fair game. But for some reason, Papangeli keeps jumping straight to the healer from Galilee. Completely untroubled by the obvious relationship between the cult of Demeter, Persephone, and Dionysus on the one hand, and the cult of Jesus on the other, the archaeologist has spent all morning leading me through some of the most concrete examples on her site. She has shown me up close how key elements of the ancient mysteries never really disappeared. They merely stepped into the shoes of Christianity and kept marching forward. The first unprompted lesson in pagan continuity came at the very beginning of our tour, when Papangeli appeared in Marcus Aurelius's courtyard in a sleek pair of sunglasses. As we crossed the Greater Propylaia, the monumental entrance to the more sacred areas of the precinct, the excavator motioned to the well-preserved marble of another former gateway on the right, the Lesser Propylaia. Carved in the 1st century BC, the architrave or beam that once topped the double columns of the portal is now arranged in bulky fragments on the ground. The symbols of the mysteries are distinctly recognizable in high relief. From left to right, on one chest-high chunk of white stone, I scanned sheaves of grain, a rosette, and the sacred basket, or cista mystica, as it's known in Latin. On a more damaged piece to its right, I noticed the bucranium, a skull representing the bull, sometimes associated with Dionysus, that would be sacrificed in the all-night feast after the initiates had won their vision and completed the initiation. On a third and final piece of marble, another cista mystica and rosette. If there really was a psychedelic sacrament, it had to get from Athens to Eleusis somehow, and the containers carved in front of me are the prime candidates. In this kiste, explained Papangeli, using the original Greek word for a basket or hamper, they carried the sacred things. They say that it was just some grain. Others believe inside the kiste were the small clay Mycenaean idols. Either way, it was something light, because the priestesses had to transfer it to Athens and back, so it was something not very heavy. It had to be portable, right? I suggested. Yes, replied the archaeologist. A portable sacrament, maybe? Yes, perhaps. Do you think some of the ingredients of the kukian would have been in there? Maybe yes, conceded Papangeli. As the wind hissed through the cracks in the classical marble, I could sense a follow-up statement being prepared. You know, in the Orthodox Church, we have a potion too. The archaeologist was, of course, referring to the Eucharist. The more I thought about it, her casual link between the pagan and Christian sacraments wasn't all that random. It had never occurred to me before, but the fact that the cista mystica was ritually transported 13 miles from Athens to be presented here to the priestesses who would consecrate the kukion suddenly made me think of a supersized offertory procession. It's that moment of the Catholic Mass when I would watch my nervous grade school friends present the Eucharistic gifts at the altar, amusingly marching up the middle aisle of the church with the unconsecrated communion wafers and cruets of water and wine. Behind them, especially on Sundays, were the long-handled baskets full of money that the ushers had just collected in donations from the parishioners. The meaning is clear. In order for the priest to discharge his duties, transforming the bread and wine into the body and blood of Jesus, the people must first supply the raw materials and financial resources for the Mass's quintessential act. What good is a church without its congregation? The idea settled here first, of course. The cista mystica, full of secrets, wasn't the only thing the initiates sent this way. They also paid their fees to the officiants and dedicated their savings to the animal sacrifices that would take place throughout the affair, relegating participation in the mysteries to the less poor strata of the population. In addition, Papangeli pointed out the enormous grain silo to our immediate left. Every city of Greece sent part of its production of grain to the sanctuary of Demeter, she said, because according to the legend, Demeter was the one who taught the people how to cultivate the earth. In the hymn to Demeter, the Lady of the Grain dispatches the royal prince and demigod Triptolemus to teach the art of agriculture to Greeks everywhere. More than a farming lesson, Triptolemus's travels across the ancient Mediterranean are referred to by Ruck as a proselytizing mission that was analogous to that of Dionysus, as they both travel throughout the world on winged chariots drawn by serpents, spreading their respective gospels of the vine plant and the grain. In the museum at our backs, there is a marble relief from the 4th century BC depicting Triptolemus and his flying dragon cart. A very similar scene appears on a red figure skiphos, or drinking cup, from the early 5th century BC. Now in the British Museum, it was created around Athens but discovered in Capua, Italy, north of Naples. Triptolemus, holding 5 sheaves of grain in his left hand, is flanked by Demeter and Persephone, each bearing torches. The holy child Iachus clearly labeled as Dionysos, is portrayed in the processional line behind the prince. The Lady of the Grain is about to pour some liquid into the broad basin pictured in Triptolemus's right hand. If it's the Koukion, or a Koukion-like sacrament, does the gesture indicate that Demeter's actual potion found its way to ancient Greek colonists separated from the motherland, perhaps as far afield as Italy, or sites even farther west? Would they have risked the goddess's wrath by observing her holy rites outside the Eleusinian sanctuary? Either way, the grain silo on site confirms Eleusis as the hub of a wheel that enclosed the entire Greek-speaking world. The first fruits of every harvest would always find their way back here, to the unique plot of soil that held the entire human race together. The next lesson in pagan continuity came a minute later, as Papangeli indicated the small boulder embedded in the ground on the very last steps of the sacred road that took initiates up a slight gradient to the now vanished Temple of Demeter. Maybe this is the mirthless rock, the excavator instructed, referring to the so-called Agelastos Petra, where Demeter was said to have sat in mourning, waiting for Persephone to return from the depths of hell. We know that there was an enactment during the Mysteries, so we can imagine that the priestess of Demeter sat here very sad at the loss of her daughter. And some other priestess of Persephone came from over there. She signaled to the rock shelter known as the Plutonion, we just inspected, 20 paces away. Gesturing to the hollowed-out slope that rises above the archaeological site and looks down into Demeter's temple, Papangeli showed me where Persephone was resurrected from the subterranean gloom every year. A group of neo-pagans had recently left some offerings for the Queen of the Dead in a narrow crevice, a pomegranate, a sesame seed cake, almonds, walnuts, and several sprigs of olive branches. And here before the eyes of the initiates, Papangeli continued, we have the reunion of mother and daughter. It's like we Christians have the Virgin Mother who lost her child. Mater Dolorosa. I was hoping to convince the Guardian of the Secrets that I was a trustworthy member of the dying species of ancient linguists. It's the Latin phrase for the grieving mother motif in Christian devotion, Our Lady of Sorrows. The 15th century oil panel from the early Netherlandish painter Derek Boats, currently in the Art Institute of Chicago, is one of the more famous examples of the teary Mary with bloodshot eyes. Mater Dolorosa, exactly, confirmed Papangeli. Mary also had an only child who went to the underworld and then came back. It's interesting, isn't it? The whole pagan continuity hypothesis. These universal themes that Christianity seems to have absorbed from Eleusis. You could say stole. Yes, many things they stole from Eleusis. Perhaps even recycled? Yes, Papangeli doubled down. Whatever they cannot extinguish, they keep. It's a very clever technique. The ancient Mediterranean of the first century AD was a total melting pot. No faith is born in a vacuum. The gospel writers and St. Paul, perhaps even Jesus himself, would have found inspiration in the spiritual landscape of the time. In some conservative religious circles, however, the theory still smacks of heresy. It undercuts the uniqueness and originality of what is supposed to be Jesus' singular intervention into human history, with a new and unprecedented covenant that binds humanity to God through, among other things, the sacrament of the Eucharist. If the Church simply stole everything from the Greeks, it could be argued that the whole Christian enterprise is fatally flawed. And its one-of-a-kind mandate to save the human species from eternal damnation goes from something quite exceptional to something quite ordinary. So, the debate between religious authorities and secular scholars about the true origins of the rites and practices of early Christianity is an important one, with huge implications. The very first line of American historian Preserve Smith's contribution to the April 1918 issue of the philosophical journal The Monist is an excellent case in point. Those who have attended the celebration of a mass have witnessed the most ancient survival from a hoary antiquity, he wrote. Smith put particular emphasis on the word sacrament, from the Latin sacramentum, which originally meant an oath or solemn obligation. By the early decades after Jesus' death, however, it had already become the go-to translation for the Greek mysterion, the initiation into holy secrets and magical practices characteristic of all the mystery religions, including Christianity. Like the Greek mysteries, therefore, whatever the earliest followers of Jesus were doing behind closed doors at their original Eucharistic celebrations appears to have included mystical hidden rites and revealed truths. Smith identified an especially pagan influence on the so-called Gnostic churches of the time. The esoteric Christian sects that thrived in the 2nd and 3rd centuries AD, only to be condemned as heretical and erased from the history of the faith. Gnostic is derived from the Greek word gnosis, meaning knowledge. But this is no ordinary learning. These Christians were after something far more profound than the rational, down-to-earth knowledge too often made synonymous with our Greek ancestors. Today's foremost authority on this lost tradition is Princeton scholar Elaine Pagels. Her definition of gnosis from 1979 remains the best. The Greek language distinguishes between scientific or reflective knowledge, he knows mathematics, and knowing through observation or experience, he knows me, which is gnosis. As the Gnostics use the term, we could translate it as insight, for gnosis involves an intuitive process of knowing oneself. And to know oneself, they, the Gnostics claimed, is to know human nature and human destiny. To know oneself at the deepest level.